Mountain Victory. Through the cabin window, the five people watched the cavalcade toil up the muddy trail and halt at the gate. First came a man on foot, leading a horse. He wore a broad hat low on his face, his body shapeless in a weathered gray cloak from which his left hand emerged, holding the reins. The bridle was silver-mounted, the horse a gaunt, mud-splashed thoroughbred bay, wearing in place of saddle a navy blue army blanket bound on it by a piece of rope. The second horse was a short-bodied, big-headed scrub sorrel, also mud-splashed. It wore a bridle contrived of rope and wire, and an army saddle in which, perched high above the dangling stirrups, crouched a shapeless something larger than a child, which at that distance appeared to wear no garment or garments known to man. One of the three men at the cabin window left it quickly. The others, without turning, heard him cross the room swiftly and then return, carrying a long rifle. "No, you don't," the older man said. "Don't you see that cloak?" the younger said. "That rebel cloak?" "I won't have it," the other said. "They have surrendered. They have said they are whipped." Through the window they watched the horses stop at the gate. The gate was of sagging hickory, in a rock fence which straggled down a gaunt slope sharp in relief against the valley and a still further range of mountains dissolving into the low, dissolving sky. They watched the creature on the second horse descend and hand his reins also into the same left hand of the man in gray that held the reins of the thoroughbred. They watched the creature enter the gate and mount the path and disappear beyond the angle of the window. Then they heard it cross the porch and knock at the door. They stood there and heard it knock again. After a while, the older man said, without turning his head, "Go and see." One of the women, the older one, turned from the window, her feet making no sound on the floor, since they were bare. She went to the front door and opened it. The chill, wet light of the dying April afternoon fell in upon her, upon a small woman with a gnarled, expressionless face in a gray, shapeless garment. Facing her across the sill was a creature a little larger than a large monkey, dressed in a voluminous blue overcoat of a private in the Federal Army, with, tied tent-like over his head and falling about his shoulders, a piece of oilcloth which might have been cut square from the hood of a sutler's wagon. Within the orifice, the woman could see nothing whatever save the whites of two eyes, momentary and phantom-like, as with a single glance the negro examined the woman standing barefoot in her faded calico garment and took in the bleak and barren interior of the cabin hall. "Master Major Soche Waddell send he compliments and say he wishful for sleeping room for hisself and boy and two horses," he said in a pompous, parrot-like voice. The woman looked at him. Her face was like a spent mask. "We been up yonder a ways, fighting them Yankees," the negro said. "Done quit now. Gwine back home." The woman seemed to speak from somewhere behind her face, as though behind an effigy or a painted screen. "I'll ask him." "We gonna pay you," the negro said. "Pay?" Pausing, she seemed to muse upon him. "Hit ain't near a hotel on the mountain." The negro made a large gesture. "Don't make no difference. We done stayed the night in worse places than what this is. You just tell him it Marsa Soche Waddell." Then he saw that the woman was looking past him. He turned and saw the man in the worn gray cloak already halfway up the path from the gate. He came on and mounted the porch, removing with his left hand the broad slouched hat bearing the tarnished wreath of a Confederate field officer. He had a dark face, with dark eyes and black hair, his face at once thick yet gaunt and arrogant. He was not tall, yet he topped the negro by 5 or 6 inches. The cloak was weathered, faded about the shoulders where the light fell strongest. The skirts were bedraggled, frayed, mud-splashed. The garment had been patched again and again, and brushed again and again. The nap was completely gone. "Good day, madam," he said. "Have you stable room for my horses and shelter for myself and my boy for the night?" The woman looked at him with a static, musing quality, as though she had seen without alarm an apparition. "I'll have to see," she said. "I shall pay," the man said. "I know the times." "I'll have to ask him," the woman said. She turned, then stopped. The older man entered the hall behind her. He was big, in jean clothes, with a shock of iron-gray hair and pale eyes. "I am Saucier Waddell," the man in gray said. "I am on my way home to Mississippi from Virginia." "I am in Tennessee now." "You are in Tennessee," the other said. "Come in." Waddell turned to the Negro. "Take the horses on to the stable," he said. The Negro returned to the gate, shapeless in the oilcloth cape and the big overcoat, with that swaggering arrogance which he had assumed as soon as he saw the woman's bare feet and the meager, barren interior of the cabin. He took up the two bridle reins and began to shout at the horses with needless and officious vociferation, to which the two horses paid no heed, as though they were long accustomed to him. It was as if the Negro himself paid no attention to his cries, as though the shouting were merely concomitant to the action of leading the horses out of sight of the door, like an effluvium by both horses and Negro, accepted and relegated in the same instant. Through the kitchen wall, the girl could hear the voices of the men in the room from which her father had driven her when the stranger approached the house. She was about 20, a big girl with smooth, simple hair and big, smooth hands, standing barefoot in a single garment made out of flour sacks. She stood close to the wall, motionless, her head bent a little, her eyes wide and still and empty like a sleepwalker's, listening to her father and the guest enter the room beyond it. The kitchen was a plank lean-to built against the log wall of the cabin proper. From between the logs beside her, the clay chinking, dried to chalk by the heat of the stove, had fallen away in places. Stooping, the movement slow and lush and soundless as the whispering of her bare feet on the floor, she leaned her eye to one of these cracks. She could see a bare table on which sat an earthenware jug and a box of musket cartridges stenciled U.S. Army. At the table her two brothers sat in splint chairs, though it was only the younger one, the boy, who looked toward the door, though she knew, could hear now that the stranger was in the room. The older brother was taking the cartridges one by one from the box and crimping them and setting them upright at his hand like a mimic parade of troops, his back to the door where she knew the stranger was now standing. She breathed quietly. "Vatch would have shot him," she said, breathed to herself, stooping. "I reckon he will yet." Then she heard feet again, and her mother came toward the door to the kitchen, crossing and for a moment blotting the orifice. Yet she did not move, not even when her mother entered the kitchen. She stooped to the crack, her breathing regular and placid, hearing her mother clattering the stove lids behind her. Then she saw the stranger for the first time, and then she was holding her breath quietly, not even aware that she had ceased to breathe. She saw him, standing beside the table in his shabby cloak, with his hat in his left hand. Vatch did not look up. "My name is Saucier Waddell," the stranger said.
"Saucier Waddell,"
the girl breathed into the dry chinking, the crumbled and powdery wall. She could see him at full length, in his stained and patched and brushed cloak, with his head lifted a little and his face worn, almost gaunt, stamped with a kind of indomitable weariness and yet arrogant too, like a creature from another world with other air to breathe and another kind of blood to warm the veins.
"Saucier Waddell," she breathed.
"Take some whiskey," Vatch said without moving. Then suddenly, As it had been with the suspended breathing, she was not listening to the words at all, as though it were no longer necessary for her to hear, as though curiosity, too, had no place in the atmosphere in which the stranger dwelled and in which she, too, dwelled for the moment as she watched the stranger standing beside the table, looking at Vatch, and Vatch now turned in his chair, a cartridge in his hand, looking up at the stranger. She breathed quietly into the crack through which the voices came now without heat or significance, out of that dark and smoldering and violent and childlike vanity of men. "I reckon you know these when you see them, then?" "Why not? We used them, too. We never always had the time nor the powder to stop and make our own. So we had to use yours now and then, especially during the last. Maybe you would know them better if one exploded in your face. Vatch!" She now looked at her father because he had spoken. Her younger brother was raised a little in his chair, leaning a little forward, his mouth open a little. He was 17. Yet still the stranger stood looking quietly down at Vatch, his hat clutched against his worn cloak, with on his face that expression arrogant and weary and a little quizzical. "You can show your other hand, too," Vatch said. "Don't be afraid to leave your pistol go." "No," the stranger said. "I am not afraid to show it." "Take some whiskey, then," Vatch said, pushing the jug forward with emotion sliding and contemptuous. "I am obliged infinitely," the stranger said. "It's my stomach. For 3 years of war, I have had to apologize to my stomach. Now, with peace, I must apologize for it. But if I might have a glass for my boy, even after 4 years, he cannot stand cold." "So Shay Waddell," the girl breathed into the crumbled dust beyond which the voices came, not yet raised, yet forever irreconcilable and already doomed. The one blind victim, the other blind executioner. "Or maybe behind your back you would know it better. You, Vatch."
"Stop, sir. If he was in the army for as long as 1 year, he has run too, once. Perhaps oftener, if he faced the Army of Northern Virginia."
"So Shay Waddell," the girl breathed, stooping. Now she saw Waddell, walking apparently straight toward her, a thick tumbler in his left hand and his hat crumpled beneath the same arm. "Not that way," Vatch said. The stranger paused and looked back at Vatch. "Where are you aiming to go?"
"To take this out to my boy," the stranger said. "Out to the stable. I thought perhaps this door..."
His face was in profile now, worn, haughty, wasted, the eyebrows lifted with quizzical and arrogant interrogation. Without rising, Vatch jerked his head back and aside. "Come away from that door." But the stranger did not stir. Only his head moved a little, as though he had merely changed the direction of his eyes.
"He's looking at Pa," the girl breathed. "He's waiting for Pa to tell him. He ain't scared of Vatch. I knowed it."
"Come away from that door," Vatch said. "You damn nigger."
"So it's my face and not my uniform," the stranger said. "And you fought 4 years to free us, I understand." Then she heard her father speak again. "Go out the front way and around the house, stranger," he said.
"So Shay Waddell," the girl said.
Behind her, her mother clattered at the stove.
"So Shay Waddell," she said.
She did not say it aloud. She breathed again, deep and quiet and without haste.
"It's like a music. It's like a singing."
The Negro was squatting in the hallway of the barn, the sagging and broken stalls of which were empty save for the two horses. Beside him was a worn rucksack, open. He was engaged in polishing a pair of thin dancing slippers with a cloth and a tin of paste, empty save for a thin rim of polish about the circumference of the tin. Beside him on a piece of plank sat one finished shoe. The upper was cracked. It had a crude sole nailed recently and crudely on by a clumsy hand. "Thank the Lord folks can't see the bottoms of your feet," the Negro said. "Thank the Lord it's just these here mountain trash. I'd even hate for Yankees to see your feet's in these things." He rubbed the shoe, squinted at it, breathed upon it, rubbed it again upon his squatting flank. "Here," Waddell said, extending the tumbler. It contained a liquid as colorless as water. The Negro stopped, the shoe and the cloth suspended. "Which?" he said. He looked at the glass. "What's that?" "Drink it," Waddell said. "That's water." "What you bringing me water for?" "Take it," Waddell said. "It's not water." The Negro took the glass gingerly. He held it as if it contained nitroglycerin. He looked at it, blinking, bringing the glass slowly under his nose. He blinked. "Where'd you get this here?" Waddell didn't answer. He had taken up the finished slipper, looking at it. The Negro held the glass under his nose. "It smell kind of like it ought to," he said. "But I'd be dog if it looked like anything. These folks fixin' to pizen you." He tipped the glass and sipped gingerly and lowered the glass, blinking. "I didn't drink any of it," Waddell said. He set the slipper down. "You better hadn't," the Negro said. "When here I done been 4 years trying to take care of you and get you back home like what mistress told me to do. And here you sleeping in folks' barns at night like a tramp, like a patter-rolling nigger." He put the glass to his lips, tilting it and his head in a single jerk. He lowered the glass, empty. His eyes were closed. He said, "Woof," shaking his head with a violent, shuddering motion. "It smells right, and it act right, but I be dog if it look right. I reckon you better let it alone like you started out. When they try to make you drink it, you send them to me. I done already stood so much, I reckon I can stand a little more for mister's sake." He took up the shoe and the cloth again. Waddell stooped above the rucksack. "I want my pistol," he said. Again the Negro ceased, the shoe and the cloth poised. "What fur?" He leaned and looked up the muddy slope toward the cabin. "Is these folks Yankees?" he said in a whisper. "No," Waddell said, digging in the rucksack with his left hand. The Negro did not seem to hear him. "In Tennessee? You told me we was in Tennessee, where Memphis is, even if you never told me it was all this year up and down land in the Memphis country. I know I never seen none of them when I went to Memphis with your pa that time." "But you says so. And now you telling me them Memphis folks is Yankees?" "Where is the pistol?" Waddell said. "I done told you," the Negro said, "acting like you does. Letting these folks see you come walking up the road, leading Caesar case you think he tired. Making me ride whilst you walks when I can outwalk you any day you ever lived and you knows it, even if I is 40 and you 28. I got to tell your ma. I got to tell him." Waddell rose, in his hand a heavy cap and ball revolver. He chuckled it in his single hand, drawing the hammer back, letting it down again. The Negro watched him, crouched like an ape in the blue Union Army overcoat. "You put that thing back," he said. "The war done with now. They told us back there at Fergini it was done with. You don't need no pistol now. You put it back, you hear me?" "I'm going to bathe," Waddell said. "Is my shirt..." "Bathe where? In what? These folks ain't never seed a bathtub." "Bathe at the well. Is my shirt ready?" "What day is of it?" "You put that pistol back, Monsieur Soche. I gotta tell your ma on you. I gotta tell him. I just wish Master was here." "Go to the kitchen," Waddell said. "Tell them I wish to bathe in the well house.
Ask them to draw the curtain on that window there. The pistol had vanished beneath the gray cloak. He went to the stall where the thoroughbred was. The horse nuzzled at him, its eyes rolling soft and wild. He patted its nose with his left hand. It whickered, not loud, its breath sweet and warm. The Negro entered the kitchen from the rear. He had removed the oilcloth tent, and he now wore a blue forage cap, which, like the overcoat, was much too large for him, resting upon the top of his head in such a way that the unsupported brim oscillated faintly when he moved, as though with a life of its own. He was completely invisible, save for his face between cap and collar, like a dried Dyack trophy, and almost as small, and dusted lightly over as with a thin pallor of wood ashes by the cold. The older woman was at the stove on which frying food now hissed and sputtered. She did not look up when the Negro entered. The girl was standing in the middle of the room, doing nothing at all. She looked at the Negro, watching him with a slow, grave, secret, unwinking gaze as he crossed the kitchen with that air of swaggering, caricatured assurance and upended a block of wood beside the stove and sat upon it. "If dis yere's de kind of weather y'all has up here all de time," he said, "I don't care if de Yankees does has dis country." He opened the overcoat, revealing his legs and feet as being wrapped, shapeless and huge, in some muddy and anonymous substance resembling fur, giving them the appearance of two muddy beasts the size of half-grown dogs lying on the floor. Moving a little nearer the girl thought quietly, "It's fur. He taken and cut up a fur coat to wrap his feet in." "Yes, sir," the Negro said. "Just y'all let me get home again, and the Yankees can have all the rest of it." "Where do you uns live?" the girl said. The Negro looked at her. "In Mississippi, on the domain. Ain't you never hear tell of County Maison?" "County Maison?" "That's it. His grandpappy named it County Maison, 'cause it's bigger than a county to ride over. You can't ride across it on a mule betwixt sunup and sundown. That's how come." He rubbed his hands slowly on his thighs. His face was now turned toward the stove. He snuffed loudly. Already the ashy overlay on his skin had disappeared, leaving his face dead black, wizened, his mouth a little loose, as though the muscles had become slack with usage, like rubber bands. Not the eating muscles, the talking ones. "I reckon we is getting nigh home after all. Leastways, dat hog meat smell like it do down where folks lives." "County Maison," the girl said in a rapt, bemused tone, looking at the Negro with her grave, unwinking regard. Then she turned her head and looked at the wall, her face perfectly serene, perfectly inscrutable, without haste, with a profound and absorbed deliberation. "That's it," the Negro said. "Even Yankees is heard tell of Waddell's County Maison, and about Master Francis Waddell. Maybe y'all seed him pass in de carriage dat time he went to Washington to tell y'all's president how he ain't liked the way y'all's president was treating de people. He rid all the way to Washington in de carriage, with two niggers to drive and to heat de bricks to keep he foots warm, and de man done gone on ahead with de wagon and de fresh horses. He carried y'all's president two whole dressed bears and 8 sides of smoked deer venison. He must have passed right out there in front y'all's house. I reckon your pappy or maybe his pappy seed him pass." He talked on, voluble, in soporific sing-song, his face beginning to glisten, to shine a little with the rich warmth, while the mother bent over the stove, and the girl, motionless, static, her bare feet cupped smooth and close to the rough puncheons, her big, smooth, young body cupped soft and richly mammalian to the rough garment, watching the Negro with her ineffable and unwinking gaze, her mouth open a little. The Negro talked on, his eyes closed, his voice interminable, boastful, his air lazily intolerant, as if he were still at home and there had been no war and no harsh rumors of freedom and of change. And he, a stableman in the domestic hierarchy, a man of horses, were spending the evening in the quarters among field hands, until the older woman dished the food and left the room, closing the door behind her. He opened his eyes at the sound and looked toward the door and then back to the girl. She was looking at the wall, at the closed door through which her mother had vanished.
"Don't they let you eat at the table with them?" he said.
The girl looked at the Negro, unwinking. "County Maison," she said. "Vatch says he is a nigger too."
"Who? Him? A nigger? Massa Soche Waddell? Which in his Vatch?"
The girl looked at him.
"It's 'cause y'all ain't never been nowhere. Ain't never seed nothing. Living up here on a naked hill where you can't even see smoke? Him a nigger? I wish his ma could hear you say that."
He looked about the kitchen, wizened, his eyeballs rolling white, ceaseless, this way and that. The girl watched him.
"Do the girls there wear shoes all the time?" she said.
The Negro looked about the kitchen.
"Where does y'all keep that air Tennessee spring water? Back here somewhere?"
"Spring water?"
The Negro blinked slowly.
"That air light drinking kerosene."
"Kerosene?"
"That air light-colored lamp oil what y'all drinks. Ain't you got a little of it hid back here somewhere?"
"Oh," the girl said, "you mean corn."
She went to a corner and lifted a loose plank in the floor, the Negro watching her, and drew forth another earthen jug. She filled another thick tumbler and gave it to the Negro and watched him jerk it down his throat, his eyes closed. Again he said, "Hoof," and drew his back hand across his mouth.
"What was that you asked me?" he said.
"Do the girls down there at County Maison wear shoes?"
"The ladies does. If they didn't have none, Massa Soche could sell 100 niggers and buy 'em some. Which in is it say Massa Soche a nigger?"
The girl watched him.
"Is he married?"
"Who married? Massa Soche."
The girl watched him.
"How he have time to get married with us fighting the Yankees for 4 years? Ain't been home in 4 years now where no ladies to marry is."
He looked at the girl, his eye whites a little bloodshot, his skin shining in faint and steady highlights. Thawing, he seemed to have increased in size a little, too.
"What's it to you, if he married or no?"
They looked at each other. The Negro could hear her breathing. Then she was not looking at him at all, though she had not yet even blinked nor turned her head.
"I don't reckon he'd have any time for a girl that didn't have any shoes," she said.
She went to the wall and stooped again to the crack. The Negro watched her. The older woman entered and took another dish from the stove and departed without having looked at either of them. The four men, the three men and the boy, sat about the supper table. The broken meal lay on thick plates. The knives and forks were iron. On the table, the jug still sat. Waddell was now cloakless. He was shaven, his still damp hair combed back. Upon his bosom, the ruffles of the shirt frothed in the lamplight, the right sleeve, empty, pinned across his breast with a thin gold pin. Under the table, the frail and mended dancing slippers rested among the brogans of the two men and the bare, splayed feet of the boy.
"Vatch says you are a nigger," the father said.
Waddell was leaning a little back in his chair.
"So that explains it," he said.
"I was thinking that he was just congenitally ill-tempered, and having to be a victor, too."
"Are you a nigger?" the father said.
"No," Waddell said.
He was looking at the boy, his weathered and wasted face a little quizzical. Across the back of his neck, his hair, long, had been cut roughly as though with a knife or perhaps a bayonet. The boy watched him in complete and rapt immobility. "As if I might be an apparition," he thought. "A hand. Maybe I am." "No," he said. "I am not a Negro."
"Who are you?" the father said.
Waddell sat a little sideways in his chair, his hand lying on the table.
"Do you ask guests who they are in Tennessee?" he said.
Vatch was filling a tumbler from the jug. His face was lowered, his hands big and hard. His face was hard. Waddell looked at him. "I think I know how you feel," he said. "I expect I felt that way once. But it's hard to keep on feeling anyway for 4 years. Even feeling at all." Vatch said something, sudden and harsh. He clapped the tumbler onto the table, splashing some of the liquor out. It looked like water, with a violent, dynamic odor. It seemed to possess an inherent volatility which carried a splash of it across the table and onto the foam of frayed yet immaculate linen on Waddell's breast, striking sudden and chill through the cloth against his flesh. "Vatch," the father said. Waddell did not move. His expression, arrogant, quizzical, and weary, did not change. "He did not mean to do that," he said. "When I do," Vatch said, "it will not look like an accident." Waddell was looking at Vatch. "I think I told you once," he said. "My name is Saucier Waddell. I am a Mississippian. I live at a place named Condomaison. My father built it and named it. He was a Choctaw chief named Francis Waddell, of whom you have probably not heard. He was the son of a Choctaw woman and a French émigré of New Orleans, a general of Napoleon's and a knight of the Legion of Honor. His name was Francois Vidal. My father drove to Washington once in his carriage to remonstrate with President Jackson about the government's treatment of his people, sending on ahead a wagon of provender and gifts, and also fresh horses for the carriage, in charge of the man, the native overseer, who was a full-blood Choctaw and my father's cousin. In the old days, the man was the hereditary title of the head of our clan. But after we became Europeanized like the white people, we lost the title to the branch which refused to become polluted, though we kept the slaves and the land. The man now lives in a house a little larger than the cabins of the Negroes, an upper servant. It was in Washington that my father met and married my mother. He was killed in the Mexican War. My mother died 2 years ago in 63 of a complication of pneumonia acquired while superintending the burying of some silver on a wet night when federal troops entered the county, and of unsuitable food. Though my boy refuses to believe that she is dead. He refuses to believe that the country would have permitted the North to deprive her of the imported Martinique coffee and the beaten biscuit which she had each Sunday noon and Wednesday night. He believes that the country would have risen in arms first. But then he is only a Negro, member of an oppressed race burdened with freedom. He has a daily list of my misdoings which he is going to tell her on me when we reach home. I went to school in France, but not very hard. Until 2 weeks ago, I was a major of Mississippi Infantry in the corps of a man named Longstreet, of whom you may have heard. So you were a major, Vatch said. That appears to be my indictment, yes. I have seen a rebel major before, Vatch said. Do you want me to tell you where I saw him? Tell me, Waddell said. He was lying by a tree. We had to stop there and lie down, and he was lying by the tree asking for water. Have you any water, friend? He said. Yes, I have water, I said. I have plenty of water. I had to crawl. I couldn't stand up. I crawled over to him and I lifted him so that his head would be propped against the tree. I fixed his face to the front. Didn't you have a bayonet? Waddell said. But I forgot. You couldn't stand up. Then I crawled back. I had to crawl back 100 yards where... Back? It was too close. Who can do decent shooting that close? I had to crawl back. And then the damned musket. Damn musket? Waddell sat a little sideways in his chair, his hand on the table, his face quizzical and sardonic, contained. I missed the first shot.
I had his face propped up and turned, and his eyes open watching me, and then I missed. I hit him in the throat, and I had to shoot again because of the damn musket.
Vatch, the father said.
Vatch's hands were on the table. His head, his face were like his father's, though without the father's deliberation. His face was furious, still unpredictable. It was that damn musket. I had to shoot 3 times. Then he had 3 eyes in a row across his face propped against the tree, all 3 of them open, like he was watching me with 3 eyes. I gave him another eye to see better with, but I had to shoot 2 times because of the damn musket.
You, Vatch, the father said.
He stood now, his hands on the table, propping his gaunt body.
Don't you mind Vatch, stranger. The war is over now.
I don't mind him, Waddell said. His hand went to his bosom, disappearing into the foam of linen while he watched Vatch steadily with his alert, quizzical, sardonic gaze. I have seen too many of him for too long a time to mind one of him anymore.
Take some whiskey, Vatch said.
Are you just making a point?
Damn the pistol, Vatch said.
Take some whiskey.
Waddell laid his hand again on the table. But instead of pouring, Vatch held the jug poised over the tumbler. He was looking past Waddell's shoulder. Waddell turned. The girl was in the room, standing in the doorway with her mother just behind her. The mother said, as if she were speaking to the floor under her feet, I tried to keep her back, like you said. I tried to. But she is strong as a man, hard-headed like a man.
You go back, the father said.
Me to go back, the mother said to the floor. The father spoke a name. Waddell did not catch it. He did not even know that he had missed it.
You go back.
The girl moved. She was not looking at any of them. She came to the chair on which lay Waddell's worn and mended cloak and opened it, revealing the 4 ragged slashes where the sable lining had been cut out as though with a knife. She was looking at the cloak when Vatch grasped her by the shoulder, but it was at Waddell that she looked.
You cut it out and give it to that nigger to wrap his feet in, she said.
Then the father grasped Vatch in turn. Waddell had not stirred, his face turned over his shoulder. Beside him, the boy was upraised out of his chair by his arms. His young, slacked face leaned forward into the lamp. But save for the breathing of Vatch and the father, there was no sound in the room.
I am stronger than you are still, the father said. I am a better man still, or as good.
You won't be always, Vatch said.
The father looked back over his shoulder at the girl.
Go back, he said.
She turned and went back toward the hall, her feet silent as rubber feet. Again the father called that name which Waddell had not caught. Again he did not catch it and was not aware again that he had not. She went out the door. The father looked at Waddell. Waddell's attitude was unchanged, save that once more his hand was hidden inside his bosom. They looked at one another. The cold Nordic face and the half-Gallic, half-Mongol face, thin and worn like a bronze casting, with eyes like those of the dead, in which only vision has ceased and not sight.
Take your horses and go, the father said.
It was dark in the hall and cold, with the black chill of the mountain April coming up through the floor about her bare legs and her body in the single coarse garment.
He cut the lining out in his cloak to wrap that nigger's feet in, she said. He done it for a nigger.
The door behind her opened. Against the lamplight a man loomed, then the door shut behind him.
Is it Vatch or Pa? She said.
Then something struck her across the back. A leather strap.
I was afeard it would be Vatch, she said.
The blow fell again.
Go to bed, the father said.
You can whip me, but you can't whip him, she said.
The blow fell again. A thick,
flat, soft sound upon her immediate flesh beneath the coarse sacking. In the deserted kitchen, the Negro sat for a moment longer on the upturned block beside the stove, looking at the door. Then he rose carefully, one hand on the wall.
"Whew," he said. "Wish us had a spring on the domain what run that. Stock would get trampled to death, show 'em on."
He blinked at the door, listening. Then he moved, letting himself carefully along the wall, stopping now and then to look toward the door and listen, his air cunning, unsteady, and alert. He reached the corner and lifted the loose plank, stooping carefully, bracing himself against the wall. He lifted the jug out, whereupon he lost his balance and sprawled on his face ludicrous and earnest with astonishment. He got up and sat flat on the floor, carefully, the jug between his knees, and lifted the jug and drank. He drank a long time.
"Whew," he said. "On the domain, we give dis yer stuff to the hogs. But dis yer ignorant mountain trash."
He drank again. Then, with the jug poised, there came into his face an expression of concern and then consternation. He set the jug down and tried to get up, sprawling above the jug, gaining his feet at last, stooped, swaying, drooling, with that expression of outraged consternation on his face. Then he fell headlong to the floor, overturning the jug. They stooped above the Negro, talking quietly to one another. Waddell in his frothed shirt, the father and the boy. "We'll have to tote him," the father said. They lifted the Negro. With his single hand, Waddell jerked the Negro's head up, shaking him. "Jubal," he said. The Negro struck out, clumsily with one arm.
"Let him be," he muttered. "Let him go."
"Jubal," Waddell said. The Negro thrashed, sudden and violent.
"You let him be," he said. "I gotta tell the man. I gotta tell him."
He ceased, muttering, "Field hands. Field niggers." "We'll have to tote him," the father said. "Yes," Waddell said. "I'm sorry for this. I should have warned you. But I didn't think there was another jug he could have gained access to." He stooped, getting his single hand under the Negro's shoulders. "Get away," the father said. "Me and Hugh can do it." He and the boy picked the Negro up. Waddell opened the door. They emerged into the high, black cold. Below them, the barn loomed. They carried the Negro down the slope.
"Get them horses out, Hugh," the father said.
"Horses?" Waddell said. "He can't ride now. He can't stay on a horse." They looked at one another, each toward the other voice in the cold, the icy silence.
"You won't go now?" the father said.
"I am sorry. You see, I cannot depart now. I will have to stay until daylight, until he is sober. We will go then."
"Leave him here. Leave him one horse and you ride on. He is nothing but a nigger."
"I am sorry. Not after 4 years." His voice was quizzical, whimsical almost, yet with that quality of indomitable weariness. "I've worried with him this far. I reckon I will get him on home."
"I have warned you," the father said.
"I am obliged. We will move at daylight. If Hewell will be kind enough to help me get him into the loft." The father had stepped back.
"Put that nigger down, Hugh," he said.
"He will freeze here," Waddell said. "I must get him into the loft." He hauled the Negro up and propped him against the wall and stooped to hunch the Negro's lax body onto his shoulder. The weight rose easily, though he did not understand why until the father spoke again.
"Hugh, come away from there."
"Yes, go," Waddell said quietly. "I can get him up the ladder." He could hear the boy's breathing, fast, young, swift with excitement, perhaps.
Waddell did not pause to speculate, nor at the faintly hysterical tone of the boy's voice.
I'll help you.
Waddell didn't object again. He slapped the Negro awake and they set his feet on the ladder rungs, pushing him upward. Halfway up, he stopped. Again, he thrashed out at them.
I gotta tell him. I gotta tell the man. I gotta tell mistress. Field hands. Field niggers.
They lay side by side in the loft, beneath the cloak and the two saddle blankets. There was no hay. The Negro snored, his breath reeking and harsh, thick. Below, in its stall, the thoroughbred stamped now and then. Waddell lay on his back, his arm across his chest, the hand clutching the stub of the other arm. Overhead, through the cracks in the roof, the sky showed. The thick, chill, black sky which would rain again tomorrow and on every tomorrow until they left the mountains. If I leave the mountains, he said quietly, motionless on his back beside the snoring Negro, staring upward. I was concerned. I had thought that it was exhausted, that I had lost the privilege of being afraid. But I have not. And so I am happy. Quite happy. He lay rigid on his back in the cold darkness, thinking of home. Quant à maison. Our lives are summed up in sounds and made significant. Victory. Defeat. Peace. Home. That's why we must do so much to invent meanings for the sounds. So damned much. Especially if you are unfortunate enough to be victorious. So damned much. It's nice to be whipped. Quiet to be whipped. To be whipped and to lie under a broken roof, thinking of home. The Negro snored. So damned much. Seeming to watch the words shape quietly in the darkness above his mouth. What would happen, say, a man in the lobby of the Gayoso in Memphis, laughing suddenly aloud? But I am quite happy. Then he heard the sound. He lay utterly still then, his hand clutching the butt of the pistol warm beneath the stub of his right arm, hearing the quiet, almost infinitesimal sound as it mounted the ladder. But he made no move until he saw the dim orifice of the trap door blotted out. Stop where you are, he said. It's me, the voice said. The voice of the boy, again with that swift, breathless quality which even now Waddell did not pause to designate as excitement or even to remark at all. The boy came on his hands and knees across the dry, sibilant chaff which dusted the floor. Go ahead and shoot, he said. On his hands and knees he loomed above Waddell with his panting breath. I wish I was dead. I so wish it. I wish we was both dead. I could wish like Vatch wishes. Why did Ewens have to stop here?
Waddell had not moved.
Why does Vatch wish I was dead? Because he can still hear Ewens yelling. I used to sleep with him and he wakes up at night and once Paul had to keep him from choking me to death before he waked up and him sweating, hearing Ewens yelling still. Without nothing but unloaded guns yelling, Vatch said, like scarecrows across a corn patch, running.
He was crying now, not aloud.
Damn you! Damn you to hell!
Yes, Waddell said. I have heard them myself. But why do you wish you were dead?
Because she was trying to come herself. Only she had to...
Who?
She. Your sister. Had to go through the room to get out. Paul was awake. He said, if you go out that door, don't you never come back. And she said, I don't aim to. And Vatch was awake, too, and he said, make him marry you quick because you were going to be a widow at daylight. And she come back and told me. But I was awake, too. She told me to tell you.
Tell me what?
Waddell said. The boy cried quietly, with a kind of patient and utter despair.
I told her if you was a nigger, and if she done that, I told her that I...
What? If she did what? What does she want you to tell me?
About the window into the attic where her and me sleep. There is a foot ladder I made to come back from hunting at night for you to get in. But I told her if you was a nigger and if she'd done that, I would...
Now then, Waddell said sharply. Pull yourself together now. Don't you remember? I never even saw her but that one time when she came in the room and your father sent her out.
But you saw her then, and she saw you.
No, Waddell said. The boy ceased to cry. He was quite still above Waddell.
No, what?
I won't do it. Climb up your ladder. For a while the boy seemed to muse above him, motionless, breathing slow and quiet now. He spoke now in a musing, almost dreamy tone.
I could kill you easy. You ain't got but one arm, even if you are older.
Suddenly he moved, with almost unbelievable quickness. Waddell's first intimation was when the boy's hard, over-large hands took him by the throat. Waddell did not move.
I could kill you easy, and wouldn't none mind.
Shh, Waddell said. Not so loud.
Wouldn't none care.
He held Waddell's throat with hard, awkward restraint. Waddell could feel the choking and the shaking expend itself somewhere about the boy's forearms before it reached his hands, as though the connection between brain and hands was incomplete.
Wouldn't none care?
Except Vatch would be mad.
I have a pistol, Waddell said.
Then shoot me with it.
Go on.
No.
No what?
I told you before.
You swear you won't do it? Do you swear?
Listen a moment, Waddell said. He spoke now with a sort of soothing patience, as though he spoke one-syllable words to a child. I just want to go home. That's all. I have been away from home for 4 years. All I want is to go home. Don't you see? I want to see what I have left there after 4 years.
What do you do there?
The boy's hands were loose and hard about Waddell's throat, his arms still, rigid.
Do you hunt all day? And all night too, if you won't? With a horse to ride and niggers to wait on you? To shine your boots and saddle the horse? And you setting on the gallery, eating, until time to go hunting again?
I hope so. I haven't been home in 4 years, you see. So I don't know anymore.
Take me with you.
I don't know what's there, you see. There may not be anything there. No horses to ride and nothing to hunt. The Yankees were there, and my mother died right afterward, and I don't know what we would find there until I can go and see.
I'll work. We'll both work. You can get married in Maysfield. It's not far.
Married? Oh. You're... I see. How do you know I am not already married? Now the boy's hands shut on his throat, shaking him.
Stop it, he said. If you say you have got a wife, I will kill you, the boy said.
No, Waddell said. I am not married.
And you don't aim to climb up that foot ladder?
No.
I never saw her but once. I might not even know her if I saw her again.
She says different.
I don't believe you.
You are lying.
No, Waddell said.
Is it because you are afraid to?
Yes. That's it.
Of Vatch?
Not Vatch. I'm just afraid. I think my luck has given out. I know that it has lasted too long. I am afraid that I shall find that I have forgot how to be afraid. So I can't risk it. I can't risk finding that I have lost touch with truth. Not like Jubal here. He believes that I still belong to him. He will not believe that I have been freed. He won't even let me tell him so. He does not need to bother about truth, you see.
We would work. She might not look like the Mississippi women that wear shoes all the time, but we would learn. We would not shame you before them.
No, Waddell said. I cannot.
Then you go away. Now.
How can I? You see that he cannot ride, cannot stay on a horse. The boy did not answer at once. An instant later, Waddell could almost feel the tenseness, the utter immobility, though he himself had heard no sound. He knew that the boy, crouching, not breathing, was looking toward the ladder.
Which one is it? Waddell whispered. It's Pa.
I'll go down. You stay here. You keep my pistol for me. The dark air was high, chill, cold. In the vast, invisible darkness the valley lay, the opposite cold and invisible range black on the black sky. Clutching the stub of his missing arm across his chest, he shivered slowly and steadily. Go, the father said. The war is over, Waddell said. Vatch's victory is not my trouble. Take your horses and nigger and ride on.
If you mean your daughter, I never saw her but once and I never expect to see her again.
Ride on, the father said. Take what is yours and ride on. I cannot. They faced one another in the darkness. After 4 years, I have bought immunity from running.
You have till daylight.
I have had less than that in Virginia for 4 years, and this is just Tennessee. But the other had turned. He dissolved into the black slope. Waddell entered the stable and mounted the ladder. Motionless above the snoring Negro, the boy squatted.
Leave him here, the boy said. He ain't nothing but a nigger. Leave him and go.
No, Waddell said. The boy squatted above the snoring Negro. He was not looking at Waddell, yet there was between them, quiet and soundless, the cops, the sharp, dry report, the abrupt, wild thunder of upreared horse, the wisping smoke.
I can show you a shortcut down to the valley. You will be out of the mountains in 2 hours. By daybreak, you will be 10 miles away.
I can't. He wants to go home, too. I must get him home, too. He stooped. With his single hand, he spread the cloak awkwardly, covering the Negro closer with it. He heard the boy creep away, but he did not look. After a while, he shook the Negro.
Jubal, he said.
The Negro groaned. He turned heavily, sleeping again. Waddell squatted above him as the boy had done.
I thought that I had lost it for good, he said. The peace and the quiet. The power to be afraid again.
The cabin was gaunt and bleak in the thick, cold dawn when the two horses passed out the sagging gate and into the churned road, the Negro on the thoroughbred, Waddell on the sorrel. The Negro was shivering. He sat hunched and high, with updrawn knees, his face almost invisible in the oilcloth hood.
I told you they was fixing to pison us with that stuff, he said. I told you. Hillbilly rednecks. And you not only let them pison me, you forced me to pison with your own hand. Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, if we ever does get home.
Waddell looked back at the cabin, at the weathered, blank house where there was no sign of any life, not even smoke.
She has a young man, I suppose? A beau.
He spoke aloud, musing, quizzical.
And that boy, Hugh.
He said to come within sight of a laurel copse where the road disappears and take a path to the left. He said we must not pass that copse.
Who says which? The Negro said. I ain't going nowhere. I'm going back to that loft and lay down.
All right, Waddell said. Get down.
Get down?
I'll need both horses. You can walk on when you are through sleeping.
I gotta tell your ma, the Negro said. I gotta tell him.
Gotta tell how after 4 years you ain't got no more sense than to not know a Yankee when you see them. To stay tonight with Yankees and let them poison one of Mister's niggers. I gotta tell him.
I thought you were going to stay here, Waddell said.
He was shivering too.
Yet I am not cold, he said. I am not cold.
Stay here?
Me?
How in the world you ever get home without me? What I tell missus when I come in without you and she asks me where you is?
Come, Waddell said.
He lifted the sorrel into motion. He looked quietly back at the house, then rode on. Behind him on the thoroughbred, the Negro muttered and mumbled to himself in woebegone sing-song. The road, the long hill which yesterday they had toiled up, descended now. It was muddy, rock-churned, scarred across the barren and rocky land beneath the dissolving sky, jolting downward to where the pines and laurel began. After a while, the cabin had disappeared.
And so I am running away, Waddell said.
When I get home, I shall not be very proud of this.
Yes, I will.
It means that I am still alive. Still alive, since I still know fear and desire. Since life is an affirmation of the past and a promise to the future. So I am still alive.
Ah. It was the laurel copse. About 300 yards ahead, it seemed to have sprung motionless and darkly secret in the air, which of itself was mostly water.
He drew rein sharply. The Negro, hunched, moaning, his face completely hidden, overriding him unawares until the thoroughbred stopped of its own accord.
But I don't see any path, Waddell said.
Then a figure emerged from the copse, running toward them. Waddell thrust the reins beneath his groin and withdrew his hand inside his cloak. Then he saw that it was the boy. He came up trotting. His face was white, strained, his eyes quite grave.
It's right yonder, he said.
Thank you, Waddell said. It was kind of you to come and show us, though we could have found it, I imagine.
Yes,
the boy said, as though he had not heard. He had already taken the sorrel's bridle.
Right t'other of the bush. You can't see it until you were in it.
In what? The Negro said.
I gotta tell him. After 4 years, you ain't got no more sense.
Hush, Waddell said. He said to the boy, I am obliged to you. You'll have to take that in lieu of anything better. And now you get on back home. We can find the path. We will be all right now.
They know the path, too, the boy said.
He drew the sorrel forward.
Come on.
Wait, Waddell said, drawing the sorrel up. The boy still tugged at the bridle, looking on ahead toward the copse. So we have one guess, and they have one guess. Is that it?
Damn you to hell, come on, the boy said, in a kind of thin frenzy. I am sick of it. Sick of it!
Well, Waddell said. He looked about, quizzical, sardonic, with his gaunt, weary, wasted face.
But I must move. I can't stay here, not even if I had a house, a roof to live under. So I have to choose between three things.
That's what throws a man off. That extra alternative. just when he has come to realize that living consists in choosing wrongly between two alternatives, to have to choose among three.
You go back home. The boy turned and looked up at him.
We'd work. We could go back to the house now, since Pa and Vatch are... We could ride down the mountain, two on one horse and two on the other. We could go back to the valley and get married at Maysfield. We would not shame you.
But she has a young man, hasn't she? Somebody that waits for her at church on Sunday and walks home and takes Sunday dinner and maybe fights the other young men because of her.
You won't take us then?
No. You go back home. For a while the boy stood, holding the bridle, his face lowered. Then he turned. He said quietly,
Come on, then. We got to hurry.
Wait, Waddell said. What are you going to do?
I'm going to peace with you.
Come on.
He dragged the sorrel forward toward the roadside. Here, Waddell said. You go on back home. The war is over now. Vatch knows that. The boy did not answer. He led the sorrel into the underbrush. The thoroughbred hung back.
Whoa, you Caesar, the Negro said. Wait, Master Soche. I ain't gwine ride down no...
The boy looked over his shoulder without stopping.
You keep back there, he said. You keep where you are.
The path was a faint scar, doubling and twisting among the brush.
I see it now, Waddell said. You go back. I'll go a piece with you, the boy said,
so quietly that Waddell discovered that he had been holding his breath in a taut, strained alertness. He breathed again while the sorrel jolted stiffly downward beneath him. Nonsense, he thought. He will have me playing Indian also in 5 minutes more. I had wanted to recover the power to be afraid, but I seem to have outdone myself. The path widened. The thoroughbred came alongside, the boy walking between them. Again he looked at the Negro.
You keep back, I tell you, he said.
Why back? Waddell said.
He looked at the boy's wan, strained face. He thought swiftly, I don't know whether I am playing Indian or not. He said aloud, Why must he keep back? The boy looked at Waddell. He stopped, pulling the sorrel up.
We'd work, he said. We wouldn't shame you.
Waddell's face was now as sober as the boy's. They looked at one another. Do you think we have guessed wrong?
We had to guess. We had to guess one out of three.
Again, it was as if the boy had not heard him.
You won't think it is me? You swear it?
Yes, I swear it. He spoke quietly, watching the boy. They spoke now as two men or two children. What do you think we ought to do?
Turn back. They will be gone now. We could...
He drew back on the bridle. Again the thoroughbred came abreast and forged ahead.
You mean it could be along here? Waddell said.
Suddenly he spurred the sorrel, jerking the clinging boy forward.
Let go, he said.
The boy held on to the bridle, swept forward until the two horses were again abreast. On the thoroughbred, the Negro perched, high-kneed, his mouth still talking, flobbed down with ready speech, easy and worn with talk like an old shoe with walking.
I done told him and told him, the Negro said.
Let go, Waddell said, spurring the sorrel, forcing its shoulder into the boy.
Let go!
You won't turn back, the boy said.
You won't?
Let go, Waddell said. His teeth showed a little beneath his mustache. He lifted the sorrel bodily with the spurs. The boy let go of the bridle and ducked beneath the thoroughbred's neck. Waddell, glancing back as the sorrel leaped, saw the boy surge upward and on to the thoroughbred's back, shoving the Negro back along its spine until he vanished.
They think you will be riding the good horse, the boy said in a thin, panting voice. I told them you would be riding down the mountain, he cried as the thoroughbred swept past. The horse can make it. Get out in the path. Get out in the... Waddell spurred the sorrel. Almost abreast, the two horses reached the bend where the path doubled back upon itself and into a matted shoulder of laurel and rhododendron. The boy looked back over his shoulder. Keep back, he cried. Get out in the path. Waddell roweled the sorrel. On his face was a thin grimace of exasperation and anger, almost like smiling. It was still on his dead face when he struck the earth, his foot still fast in the stirrup. The sorrel leaped at the sound and dragged Waddell to the path's side and halted and whirled and snorted once and began to graze. The thoroughbred, however, rushed on past the curve and whirled and rushed back, the blanket twisted under its belly and its eyes rolling, springing over the boy's body where it lay in the path, the face wrenched sideways against a stone, the arms back sprawled, open-palmed, like a woman with lifted skirts springing across a puddle. Then it whirled and stood above Waddell's body, whinnying, with tossing head, watching the laurel copse and the fading gout of black powder smoke as it faded away. The Negro was on his hands and knees when the two men emerged from the copse. One of them was running. The Negro watched him run forward, crying monotonously, "The darn fool! The darn fool! The darn fool!" and then stopped suddenly and dropped the gun. Squatting, the Negro saw him become stone still above the fallen gun, looking down at the boy's body with an expression of shock and amazement like he was waking from a dream. Then the Negro saw the other man. In the act of stopping, the second man swung the rifle up and began to reload it. The Negro did not move. On his hands and knees, he watched the two white men, his irises rushing and wild in the bloodshot whites. Then he too moved, and still on hands and knees, he turned and scuttled to where Waddell lay beneath the sorrel and crouched over Waddell and looked again and watched the second man backing slowly away up the path, loading the rifle. He watched the man stop. He did not close his eyes nor look away. He watched the rifle elongate and then rise and diminish slowly and become a round spot against the white shape of Vatch's face, like a period on a page. Crouching, the Negro's eyes rushed wild and steady and red, like those of a cornered animal.